Existential therapy is an outgrowth of a philosophical system that has been around since about the first decade of the 20th century. Prior to that, obviously, people have been asking questions about what it means to exist. What is it to be a human being? What can we know is truly real as opposed to a manifestation of the mind, and so forth? These are fundamental questions that philosophers, particularly Western philosophers, have been asking since the very beginning of our culture. But around the first decade of the 20th century, a way of asking these questions, or asking some of these questions, was developed. It fell under the title of a system of philosophy that's become known as phenomenology. And phenomenology arose in continental Europe. It was founded by an Austrian philosopher called Edmund Husserl. And Husserl was primarily concerned with questions around the interaction between consciousness and reality. And his main question was around what is truly real, and what can we access of the reality of the world. He developed a way of asking these questions that is still being utilized within phenomenology in general. But not long after Husserl devised this approach, this way of asking questions, an assistant of his, a German assistant called Martin Heidegger, decided that these questions about reality and so forth, as important as they were insignificant insofar as there was a more central question that he thought needed to be asked. And that central question was, what is it to be? What is it to exist? Why is there existence in the first place? How is there that there are beings in the world? How did that happen? And what does it mean to exist in the world? And by the by, what does it mean to exist in the world as a human being? What is it to be human? What distinguishes our being, our stance in the world? So Heidegger asked a lot of fascinating questions. And like most existential thinkers, he was very good at asking questions and very bad at giving answers. So he raises the questions, but the answers that are provided are very few and far between. There's not a great deal in terms of answers. The only answers really emerge through the asking of the questions. You ask the questions and some sense of clarification begins to happen. But there's no sense of a final answer to anything, or no conclusive answer. This was all within the realm of philosophy. But a number of people who were reading these philosophical texts, who were mainly initially from the medical profession, or broadly speaking, from psychiatry, asked themselves, are these questions relevant to what we do as practitioners? Is there something in both the questions that are being asked and the way that the questions are being asked that is applicable to our enterprise? You know, so the rise of phenomenology coincided fairly closely with the rise and development of modern-day psychotherapy. You know, so there's a relatively good parallel taking place. And as phenomenology and existential phenomenology, or existentialism as it got shortened, began to evolve, so too did psychotherapy begin to evolve. And there's a coincidental line of inquiry between the two. What would a psychotherapy that asked the kinds of questions that existential phenomenology is asking, what would it look like? And what would it provide? And what could it offer the patients, the clients that came to psychotherapy? So a number of practitioners, influenced by the writings and the ideas of Husserl or Heidegger or subsequently Sartre, began to consider their work from the angle of these questions and from the angle of the methodology that was utilized by phenomenologists to ask these questions, to develop their understanding of these questions. It has to be said that existential therapy is full of paradoxes. It's difficult to pin down in terms of what it might be or what it actually has to say about itself or about its enterprise or about therapy itself. Unlike most other models of therapy, existential therapy has no clear-cut, single founding figure. You know, there's no primary father or mother who kind of generates the approach, the model, the system. There are a number of competing voices, and in some ways they share similarities in that they all go back to the philosophers, but the way that they then interpret the philosophers in an applied way to psychotherapy varies quite significantly. So although existential therapy is practiced all over the world, the way it is practiced, the understanding that is given to it, the emphases that are presented vary from place to place, from culture to culture, within cultures, depending upon how the thinking has emerged and presented itself. There's a funnier kind of paradox as well that we have to confront here. At the moment, by far the most well-known living existential therapist is an American psychiatrist called Irvin Yalom. He's by far the most famous, the most well-known, the person who is most immediately associated with existential psychotherapy. And, you know, he has several books on the topic, and particularly one major tome that's simply entitled Existential Psychotherapy. However, Yalom himself does not believe that existential therapy is possible. He doesn't take for a moment the idea that there can be something called existential therapy. What Yalom believes is that therapy should be asking a number of questions that form central existential themes. Questions around individuality, questions around meaning and meaninglessness, questions around isolation, questions around control and responsibility. So he believes that there are important existential themes that therapy should be addressing directly. And his argument is that it doesn't matter what kind of therapy it is, as long as that therapy addresses these central themes. So you could have an analytically focused therapy that is concerned with themes of meaninglessness, or themes of isolation, or themes of responsibility. And for Yalom, that would be as far as an existential therapy could go. So you could have CBT that is existentially thematic. You could have person-centered therapy that's existentially thematic. You could have analytic therapy that's existentially thematic. But for him, the idea of a separate, distinct model of therapy that calls itself existential psychotherapy makes no sense whatsoever. Now, I don't agree with him. We've had discussions about this. And my position, like that of a number of existential therapists here and elsewhere, is that actually you can have a distinct, specific model approach to therapy that can be called existential therapy. But in making that claim, I then have to follow that up by saying, okay, so what distinguishes it? What is it that would identify existential therapy from other models of therapy? What are its features? What are its characteristics? And there you've got initially a set of problems. It's not just a set of problems that existential therapy faces. It's a set of problems that most models of therapy face. Most models of therapy have rarely gone into the details of what their underlying principles are. You know, they identify themselves, they say we do this or that, this is how we think about things, or these are the theories we hold, or the hypotheses we maintain. But very rarely have therapists gone into the depth of their approach and asked themselves, what are the foundational principles that uphold our approach? What would you see as an overriding principle that no matter how many manifestations there may be of the model, that those principles are there, are apparent? Huh? So, for example, if you take psychoanalysis, and psychoanalysis is full of competing theoretical models, Freudian, Kleinian, Winnicottian, Jungian, all kinds of models that have some points of connection and some points of real serious contradiction, or different interpretations. But when you ask, what are the primary principles, what are the foundational principles of psychoanalysis? What would you find, regardless of the particular trajectory that psychoanalysis has taken, what would you find across the board that would identify an approach as a psychoanalytic approach? Then there are very few such principles. The most obvious one would be that whatever the approach was, It would be psychoanalytic insofar as it acknowledged and worked with a notion of what it calls the unconscious. You know, so the principle of the unconscious would be a foundational principle that, regardless of which model of psychoanalysis one is taking, you would find that principle to be apparent, to be present. A second principle would be that of transference. You know, so again, transference can be interpreted in any number of ways, but nonetheless, in order for a model to see itself as a psychoanalytic model, it would adopt a principle that acknowledged and worked with the notion of transference. Yeah? If you take person-centered therapy and you say, what would be the underlying principles of person-centered therapy? So again, there are many variations. You have relationally focused person-centered therapy. You have Rogerian focused person-centered. You've got all kinds of competing perspectives in person-centered therapy. But what would be the unifying principles? And my sense is that probably it would be something around an assumption of the possibility of genuineness. That there is a distinction that can be made between that which is the genuine human being, the genuine person, and the false manifestations of personhood. So regardless of which particular branch of person-centered therapy you would take, you would find that underlying principle. Within CBT, it's really interesting because I've been looking at CBT quite closely for a few years now, trying to work out something with a colleague of mine. And we've been asking that same question. What would be the underlying principles of CBT? CBT appears like a unified system, but actually is full of very, very different and quite often extremely contradictory subsystems that have very different perspectives on how to work, on how to understand human beings, and so forth. But nonetheless, what would unify all of the competing perspectives that label themselves as CBT? And the only principle that we've managed to find that unifies them all is the adherence to experimental research. So that would be a primary underlying principle of CBT. All the other ones that one might think of initially fall apart because there are competing perspectives that would either work with or reject other secondary principles. So every model of therapy has its underlying primary principles. And if existential therapy is going to claim that it too is an identifiable model, distinct from other models, then it too must have its underlying principles. What might they be? Huh? Well, as I said, not many existential therapists have actually tried to explore this question. You know, they've had other issues to deal with. But a few years ago, I made a proposal, a suggestion. I think there might be at least three key principles that underpin any approach, however diverse, that would call itself an existential approach. So I want to briefly highlight for you what I think might be the three foundational principles to existential thinking, to existential thought, and to its practice in psychotherapy. Okay. I hope you can see them. Can you see them? So I think the three principles are these: the principle of relatedness, the principle of uncertainty, and the principle of anxiety. So I want to say something about each one. So let's start with the first, relatedness, which in many ways is the most foundational of the foundational principles. The other two principles arise largely out of the principle of relatedness. What is existential thought trying to express through this term? And I have to say from the start, it's a lousy term. It's confusing in what it seems to be expressing as opposed to what it wants to express. But it's the term we've got, so we've got to work with that. So what is relatedness as far as existential thought and therapy understands it to be? There's two ways of looking at it. You can look at relatedness from a surface standpoint, and then you can look at it from the deeper standpoint. From the surface standpoint, relatedness basically argues everything is interconnected. Nothing exists on its own. To understand myself, to understand who I am, I have to place myself in the context of all of my world relations, past, future, present, all of those influences that come upon me, influences that I can identify, as well as those influences that are so that are present but not apparent. So, at a surface level, relatedness is just saying, look, we can only understand ourselves to the degree that we place ourselves in a context of inseparable relatedness with others and with the world. There's no way of identifying the person in isolation. The idea of thinking about the person as a separate, distinct, isolated being that can be made sense of only through a kind of intrapsychic understanding, existentially speaking, makes no sense whatsoever. The person can only begin to be understood if placed in the context of all of his or her relations with others, with the world, with time, with place, with culture, with body, with all manner of factors that come into play. At this surface level of relatedness, a few years ago, there was a really nice, catchy advert that I can't remember if it was Orange or if it was T-Mobile, and the phrase that they used to, I don't know why they used it, but to attract people to buy their mobile phone was this: I am who I am because of everyone. Yeah? And in that sense, it captures the surface meaning of what existential relatedness is attempting to express. The way I understand myself, how I understand myself, who I claim to be, is not a product of self-creation alone. I am created through all the interactions and conditions of the world. And these relations are inseparable from me. I can't distance myself from them and say, okay, I can bracket those or I can put those aside and then I can find out who I really am in and of myself. Existentially speaking, that makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah? So at a surface level, we've got a view of human beings that places them in an inevitable relational matrix with one another. And in this sense, existential thought has strong similarities with a lot of systemic systems or models of psychotherapy. Yeah, so there's a conjunction here. Systemic models also emphasize the irreducible and inevitable relatedness between beings, and the attempt to understand beings only in terms of the relations that contain them, that shape them, that, in a sense, create them. But as I said, there's a deeper meaning to, or meaning, a deeper assumption in this term that existential therapy holds, or existential thought holds. And it's a much more difficult view to express directly. We literally don't have a language that can express relatedness in its deeper meaning or in its deeper qualities. There may be other languages that do, but our language just doesn't. Our language cannot really express the deeper sense of relatedness that existential thought is attempting to communicate. So we have to do it by stupid analogies, ways that try to get us to a sense of what is being alluded to. So here's one stupid analogy. This should be a full cup of tea, but unfortunately the tea got sent away and there's only a bit of tea. But imagine that we've got a full cup of tea here, all right? And this cup of tea is the tea of being. All of being is this cup of tea, yeah? So all that is that exists is this cup of tea. Here's this spoon, and it takes out a spoonful of this being tea. And this spoonful of being tea stands out from the cup as a whole. It's unique, it's irreplaceable, it's special in the sense that never again will exactly this spoonful of tea emerge. No matter how many times I put the spoon into the cup of tea, the exact same constituents are never going to come up again. Yeah? There's a specialness to each spoonful of tea that is presented. And in that sense, this each spoonful of tea is each being. Each of us can present ourselves as analogous to the spoonful of tea. And we stand out separate, distinct, unique, irreplaceable, never to be repeated again, special. Precisely because never again will this particular combination of bits of tea emerge. Yeah? Therein lies our uniqueness. Therein lies our specialness. But the specialness and the uniqueness and the singularity only is possible because of the whole cup of tea. The whole cup of tea is the foundation around which the individual bit of tea emerges. And it's this foundational cup or blob of tea or whatever you want to call it that is what existential thought is alluding to when it talks about relatedness in the deeper sense. That we all only exist as individuals, specific, unique, irreplaceable, special, as a consequence of a grounding that allows individuality to emerge. So, if you speak of it in other languages that maybe make more sense, you might say existential thought argues that the what might be called the intersubjective or the relational exists prior to the subjective. It's not that there's subjectivity and then there's parallel to that, there's an intersubjective realm. It's that intersubjectivity is the source to all subjective experience. It is primary. The self is an expression or a consequence of a foundational set of relational conditions. Do you understand? Well, I don't, but it's a tough one. But the basic idea is what I think what I've tried to communicate to you. That we're all emergent expressions of a foundational baseline that I think unfortunately has been called relatedness. And I say unfortunately because relatedness, the term suggests a distinct being relating to another distinct being. And while that's true at a surface level, at the deeper level of this term, it's not about distinct being, it's about what permits distinct beings to emerge, to become. Now, other than allude to this foundational level, not much more can be said about it, because we're distinct beings talking about something which has shaped us, which underpins our distinctiveness, our uniqueness, our specialness. So the only way that we can address it is paradoxically through the exploration of our uniqueness, our specialness, our distinctiveness. Through distinctiveness, we might begin to capture or approach that which is the universal that literally shapes and contains us. Okay, now I could spend the rest of today and maybe several other days trying to talk about this idea, but I'm going to leave it at that point. I hope you've gotten some sense of what the argument is trying to say. Even if you just got it at the surface level, that's fine. That's okay. It'll be enough. Yeah? But if you start from either the surface meaning of relatedness or the deeper meaning of relatedness, then inevitably, if you accept that principle, then you're forced into a recognition of uncertainty. So the second principle. If I accept an unbreakable relational set of conditions that shape me, that literally construct who I am, relational conditions that are both internal and external, though those terms are in themselves somewhat misleading, but intrapsychic and interpsychic. If I accept that principle of relatedness, then as a consequence, I'm forced to acknowledge a disturbing conclusion. Everything that I claim to be, or all those manifestations of myself that I argue are who I am, of necessity become uncertain. I cannot truly pin myself down in any complete, final, consistent, coherent way. I'm forced into an awareness that says, at best, I've made assumptions about who this being is, and what he or she is capable of, and what he or she does or doesn't do, or values or doesn't value, or appreciates or doesn't appreciate. But whatever the statements are that I make of myself, or indeed of others, or a particular other, or of the world in general, are question marks rather than final statements. There's always the inevitable uncertainty to my existence. That possibility that arises that says, you think you were like this, you think you were this kind of person, you think you had these ideas, you think you, or you, you know, if you don't like think, then substitute that with feel or imagine or whatever other term you want to use. But whatever it is that you imagine yourself to be prepared to be surprised. And in that sense, your existence, your sense of yourself, is an existence that is contained by an inescapable uncertainty. It's not that we're certain some of the time and then there are uncertain things in our lives. It's that uncertainty underpins our whole existence. Again, another paradox. Is this suggesting, therefore, that uncertainty is the one certainty? It seems to be suggesting that, you know? But then we have to go a further step and say, what would an uncertain uncertainty be? But we won't go there today. You know, we'll just stay with uncertainty as we are. So, uncertainty of our own being. So imagine, here's another silly analogy, or it's just a short summary of an actual event. But it captures this sense of uncertainty, I think, quite well. You've probably heard about this already. Sometime back, about 40-odd years back, a social psychologist called Stanley Milgram decided to carry out some experiments on just looking at how far people were willing to agree with activities or behavior that was challenging them. So he got ordinary people to participate in his study. He put up an ad and invited people to come along and carry out a study that claimed to be about a new way of educating people. And people were brought into the room and they were greeted by a white lab coat experimenter who sat them down in front of a machine. And the experimenter said to them, okay, you are the instructor. In the room next door to you, there's your student. And here's your task. You're going to ask a question. You wait for the student to answer that question. If they answer it correctly, go on to the next question. If they answer it incorrectly, you see this button on the far left of the machine? Press that button. That will give the person, the student, a very slight electric shock. If the person, then you move on to the next question. If the person answers it, just keep asking the questions. Every time the person makes a mistake or doesn't answer the question, you press the next button and the one after that and the one after that. And each time, the level of voltage will increase and the shock will become greater, such that by the time you get to the last button, the person will be getting something like 240 volts of shock, of electric shock. Now, when Milgram and his associates initiated this study, they argued that maybe somewhere around 10 to 15% of the population would be willing to go so far to the very end of the shock box. And much to their amazement, what they found was that actually somewhere around 74-75% of the population went all the way. And the study was repeated under different conditions. There were some variations, but by and large, the results were shocking in another sense by the degree to which people were willing to adhere to the instructions that had been given to them and carry it through. What's interesting for us is that subsequent to this, the people who did the experiments were interviewed, were questioned, and they were asked, why did you go all the way to such extremes? Why didn't you stop? And in just about every instance, people made claims that said something like, well, I had to because somebody was telling me that. But more interestingly, what they were saying was, well, you know, when I was doing it, I didn't really quite feel that it was me who was doing it. I felt that I was somebody else at that point in time. It wasn't the me that I know myself to be. And I think what they were talking about, or what they were trying to express, was that they had come up against a very powerful instance of their own uncertainty. That here they were, people going along, imagining themselves as people who would, under very rare circumstances, be willing to comply to, in effect, torturing someone. And yet, they did. And here was a challenge to their certainties about themselves. Here was a radical shift that said, huh, you thought you knew who you were and how you would be and what you would do, but that's not how you actually were. Under certain conditions, under various factors, you could be someone other than who you claim to be. And that's what uncertainty also highlights. That sense of there's always the possibility of my being surprised, shaken, disturbed by what I am capable of being. Not necessarily always in a negative way, but maybe in ways that reveal me as attentive or caring or whatever. Yeah? And this can run the gamut from ordinary, everyday circumstances of uncertainty to larger, more dramatic instances like those that were identified by Milgram. And those experiments, by the way, were repeated and have been repeated numerous times now in different parts of the world. And in each case, the same kind of results have emerged. About 3/4 of the population will continue to carry through these experiments and be shocked by what they did, and respond to that shock in a way that, in some cases, can be quite destabilizing for them, because they're confronted with their sense of, huh, I thought I knew myself, I thought I knew who I was or what I could do, and what I'm actually presented with is, it was a guess at best. Yeah? So, the principle of uncertainty underpins or is an outcome of the principle of relatedness. If you accept relatedness, then you also then have to accept that with relatedness comes the uncertainty of your own being, of how and in what way your being will manifest itself under any number of social conditions, or indeed under any number of private conditions. So that takes us then to the third principle, the principle of anxiety. And the principle of anxiety from an existential standpoint is basically saying anxiety is the lived experience of relational uncertainty. Yeah? It's how you feel, how your body responds to relational uncertainty. Now, so anxiety is a felt sense of our being. It's a felt sense that is a consequence of relational uncertainty. Now, from an existential standpoint, anxiety is a neutral term. It's not only or necessarily negative. You know, so in most of psychology and psychotherapy, when we use the word anxiety, we look at it from a standpoint of disturbance, something to be reduced or got rid of. You know, from an existential standpoint, anxiety is just a given of our being. We cannot be anything other than anxious. Why? Because if we accept the first two principles, we're in a matrix of relational uncertainty. And if I accept relational uncertainty, then I'm in a constant state of anxiety. So there's no evasion of anxiety, there's no escape from it, existentially speaking. But again, if I use words like escape or evasion, it suggests only the negative side of anxiety. And existential thought argues that anxiety also has its constructive qualities or its productive qualities. So to be creative is an expression of anxiety, because you're in your act of creation, you are allowing yourself to enter a mental, physical space where the consequences of what you're doing, or the outcome of what you're doing, or what you're attempting, is not clear. You're entering a terrain that is uncertain. And so there's an anxiety in it, because you don't know what will occur from it, but it can be an anxiety that you value. It can be an anxiety that fuels you with interest or excitement or stimulation. So anxiety can have its restrictive components. It can be deeply debilitating, destructive, but it also has its constructive, its potential, its opening. Every time I take a step to revealing myself to another, I take the risk of talking openly or honestly or truthfully about how I'm feeling, about how I am with another being. I am in that act of willingness to engage with another, immersing myself in the anxiety of that experience, because I have no idea of how the other will respond to what I say, or how I will respond to having said it or expressed it, or what will happen to us as a consequence of what is being expressed or said. At the same time, this willingness to take that risk, to enter this sense of acknowledged anxiety, enlivens me. It strikes me as these are the moments in my life that seem to be the most significant, the most valuable, the most worthwhile. If I avoided that contact, if I avoided the willingness to entertain placing myself willingly in anxious situations, what kind of life would I have? I'd have an increasingly deadening existence, a life that was constantly attempting to evade or escape or avoid anxiety, a life that became increasingly anxious through its attempt to avoid anxiety.